I was making a rake on the land with four or five more, and it seems we heard this terrible noise over the hills away from us, and one of the men remarked, he said, we'd have to hurry on, there's thunder, says he, and we'd have a flood of rain. It held for about, I suppose, about an hour and a half or 2 hours, that way. And of course, they were outnumbered by the British, of course. But there was a false message sent to the barrack here, that the barrack in Milltown was attacked. That was a trap to draw them out, you see. They wanted them to come out. And they were above them, that, of course, in Rinnean, the mountains are very high there, you know, the cliffs. And they fought off at the top of the hills there and ambushed them there. But yes, the West Clare train was due at the time, and the train pulled in, and she was held up by the Republican crowd in the line, and she was there for a long time, and the driver and the guard and firemen were taken out at gunpoint, and they were held up, and they had to leave the train on the line. So it seems they took cover then from behind the train, I suppose, while the fight was on. And then there was a message sent here to the barrack to say that the barrack in Milltown was attacked. That was in order to draw them out. But they came on then, and two or three or four lorries of them, and the fight started. But then it went on, you see, to a finish, you know. Mike had a wire, he saw the danger. There was a big gap there, and they had to cross that gap. And while they'd be crossing it, they'd be cut to pieces with machine gun fire. And the military had arrived this time, reinforcements, and they were coming up in the field to take up positions to fire them. And Mikey O'Dwyer crept out to the cocky hair that was there, and he had a full view of any of the soldiers or tanks that had come up in the field off of the public road. And he shouted back to Ignatius, "Give me the rifle," he says, "and I'll silence the gunner." So Ignatius was very slow, and he says, "Wait till the boys cross the gap." "No, it is too late, they'll be cut to pieces," he says. "'Tis now's the time, I want the rifle, and I'll silence him damn quick." So with that, he threw him the rifle, and there was supposed to be two or three rounds in it, not enough. So he threw him the belt of the bandolier of ammunition, and he loaded the rifle, and the gunner was just about to open fire when he fired and knocked him out, got him through the head. So the officer came up then, and the story goes that he fired at him, and he got him here in the chest, knocked him out. But he kept firing, and he waved his hand back, and he says, "Go on now, lads," he says, "cross, you're okay." There was a few seconds then of a relapse. The firing stopped for a few seconds, and more soldiers came up, and they were taken in certain movement to surround him. But they were gone too far, you see, to get hold of their grip. And Mikey otherwise shouted, "Keep going now, lads," he says, while the shooting has stopped. So they kept moving until they last them past this gap out of the line of fire. So he went back with him then and followed him, and he was firing as he was retreating, any soldier that would be coming close on him, he'd fire and knock him out.
Irish Times, September the 23rd, 1920. County Clare ambush. Military and police attacked. 4 police and 3 soldiers killed. It is officially stated that a police motor car was ambushed between Miltown Malbay and Lahinch, County Clare. Our Ennis correspondent telegraphs, a report has just reached Ennis of a collision between a party of police and soldiers and civilians yesterday afternoon at Rinnean, midway between Lahinch and Miltown Malbay. The military and police were in motor lorries at the time. They were attacked at a place known as Drummen Hill by a party estimated at between 100 and 150 men. 6 policemen were on the lorry. 4 were fatally wounded and 1 seriously wounded through the lung. 2 military lorries later came on the scene. The attackers fired on the military, who returned the fire. It is stated that 3 soldiers were killed. The soldiers pursued the attackers, who retreated across the hills. Further details are lacking, as it is impossible to get near the place.
I had a very wild ass in car, or a wild ass, and he was under the car, and the dibble wouldn't stop him. And it seems I was coming home with ass in car, and I was coming in by the Settler Road, and I had to pass the barrack. And the tenants were above, and they were like demons. They were looking for blood. They were mad to kill and murder all around them. So I stood in dangerous ground. I realised it in, and I couldn't stop that. He was flying. He went like a flying bomb past the barrack, and I thought to make him hit Paddy O'Neill's gable to stop him, and I couldn't stop him, and I was sawing the reins like this, and I had him nearly short, and he was flying, man, galloping. So God, I said, so they put up their hands like this, no hope of stopping him. And at last, anyway, he stopped below on the nose feet, and 4 of them came down. And they made me go back with him, and I was brought back to the barrack. And he says, take him out from under the gun carriage, he says, Paddy. So they were ripping the chains, and they were throwing the chains around his ears. They never untackled a donkey before. So with that anyway, I had to take that from under the car. So the next thing anyway, I took off the winkers, and the bridging and all the tackling that was in his back, and I threw it into the car. So they got up in his back, 5 or 6 of them, and they had a mouth organ, and they were playing God Save the King above his back. So it seems he reared up on his hind legs and he wouldn't go for him. And John Daly, the solicitor, came out and says, here, you might as well be idle, boys. The devil one of you put one leg out before another. Well, he says, we'll put the bastard gun in quick time too. We'll shove a bullet up in his aborium. I'm good. Don't you know very well that fellow's a Sinn Féiner? He won't go. And anyway, he says, you'll have to stop playing that God Save the King. Let you rattle up the soldier's song and he'll go. Well, it seems if he don't go, and it'll be a sore deal for him. I'm telling you, we'll put the bloody bullet up in his bloody son, sir. Nine coffins passed me on the road outside, just beyond at the P&T station here, that the railway station was going that time. But I was coming along the road, the same as any coffin now, right, you know, the same, and more of them were kind of a beer, all one shape. The sawdust not cut in here near the head or anything, but the Union Jack was around every coffin that was in. There was 9 in a minute, and they pulled up, and there was up to 12 or 14 of them sitting back to back with the rifles trained out on both sides of the road. And about 300 or 400 soldiers marched in from the barracks, and they arrived in a stymon. And there were some women filling buckets of water at the foot of Churchill. And the officer shouted up to them, he says, send out the men to the men we want, not the women. And so, of course, he says, get away now as quick as you can. So he didn't tell them what they were going to do, but they went clear the way. They went into Kelman's, and they took down all the bottles of whiskey and everything they could lay hands on, and they drank it, the whole lot. And whatever bottles that were there, they brought them out and smashed them in the street. And they pulled out the piano, 7 or 8 of them, and they were dancing around it. And they had a sparrow above on top of a stick, and they were singing that, all the birds in the air. Did you ever hear that? With a sigh and a sobbing, when they heard of the death of poor Cock Robin. And then they all joined in together. We buried him lower down on the banks of the Yayo and all that. And one fella would sing, who saw him die? 'Twas I, says the fly, with my little eye. 'Twas I saw him die. Now who ring the bell?
With my goodness, pull, I'll ring the bell. All the birds of the air were a-singing and the sobbing when they heard of the death of poor Cock Robin. When they heard of the death of poor Cock Robin.
They were singing away and they were dancing around the piano. Of course, they were all drunk. They were mad drunk. More of them were lying in the street. And they had all the whiskey and Kelly in the shop, drank. They sang then, where are the lads of the village tonight? Where are the boys we know? They're not in Piccadilly or Islaw Square. No, not there, I didn't say where. They're taking a trip o'er the continent with their rifles and their bayonets too. Facing danger gladly, where they're wanting badly, that's where they are to die.
Where are the lads of the village tonight? Where are the boys we know? They're not in Piccadilly or in Sloane Square. No, not there. They don't know where. They're taking a trip to the continent with their rifles and their bayonets too. Facing danger gladly, where they're wanted badly, oh, that's where they are tonight.
But they sang that while the piano was in flames. They had a lorry of petrol and to throw in the houses. So some of the RIC were there, and they knew the people, because better than the British soldiers. And they were telling them the names of the places to set fire to. And they started above us, Clare's, Mikey Clare's. And they burned that to the ground. They were very near to burning Lysett's in mistake, but the RIC, one of them, a man named Carter, he taught them not to burn that. And that they were not belong to the Republican movement or anything like that. So they passed that place and they went up to Divitt's and they threw 2 cans of petrol up on the shutters and the door and threw the match. And it was said that the soldiers were very drunk and that their tunic and their hat or helmet was found in the ruins the following morning. They must have been falling into the fire, but anyway, their clothes were found burned to a cinder there. And after that then, this fella, he was bringing a bucket of water up from the river, up through the archway now. And he had a bucket of water in his hand, and he arrived above in the street to throw it in Divitt's house to try to quench it. And the soldiers ran down, and they surrounded him. And one of them says, what the hell are you doing here, he says. So he said, account for yourself. So he said, he got frightened and he got shocked, and I couldn't say what answer he gave him, but they dragged him down, but they caught him by the legs and dragged him along the street down to the square, and they hit him into the head with the butt of the rifle, and they put him in a dying condition, and they dragged him up Parliament Street and put him again the shutter there at Paddy O'Neill's, the corner house next to the courthouse. And one fella held him again. He was in a dying condition, and one fella went out on the road, one of the tans, and he fired and shot him. So they dragged him out on the road and left him there, and he died on the street in a pool of blood. So there was a man named Michael White. He was a British soldier. Well, he fought in the war, and he was inside it at a pub. Tommy Canol was the name of the place. And someone said inside, "Poor Peter Lalanne has also been killed by the Black and Tans." "My God," he says, "I went to school with him. Poor PJ," he says. "So, God, I must go out to see alive or dead." So he came out the front door, and he passed down, and the sword it was full of military, the threes and tens. They were going up and down, they were firing shots. And he said, they surrounded him, and they asked him to account for his movements, and he said, "Well," he says, "you have shot my best friend, PJ Lalanne," he says, "I went to school with. It's awful sad," he says. "I feel very sad over it." So the soldier says, "Well," he says, "you'll get the same fate now," he says. Well, one of them caught a hold of him, and he says, "Let go of me," he says. "Where were ye," he says, "in 1914 to 18, I fought in the First War," he says. "Well, you'll have to prove that." So he pulled up his sleeve and he showed him the tattoo on his arm. And they cooled down then when they saw that. And they went away. Two of them followed him to know what was he going to do. So he went up and he saw poor Peter Lalanne lying on the street in a pool of blood. He took him up in his arms and carried him in the lane by the courthouse now, and down along, and he burst in some door there and brought him into an old cowhouse that was there, and he got a few lemonade cases and he laid him out there. After that then, they went up, the officer and the military went up, and they set fire to the town hall, and the heat from the hall was so bad that they had to creep up by the monastery wall, go on their knees up along, stoop down. The heat was terrible, but the monks were above and they were saying the rosary in the garden overlooking the lane there. So they went up then, and they came as far as Tom Kinnall. He lived above on the road to the station there. Mr. Buckley, the chemist, lived there one time, and afterwards. But Tom Kinnall and his wife and child were about going to go to bed, and Tom was saying the rosary when the officer knocked at the door, and he said, "Is there a man named Tom Kinnall here?" So the wife opened the door, and she said, "Yes, my husband, you mean. Yes, we want that man out here," he says. So it seems they took him out, they shot him on the road, and they dragged him down, further down the road. There's a cross there in memory of him. The reason they picked him out to burn him and kill him, or shoot him, where the ambush was held in the field, the officer went up and he searched the field, and he got his overcoat, and there was a letter in their pocket, and that was the cause of his death. They found the letter in his pocket, addressed to Tom Kinnall, insurance agent in Parliament Street in Stoyman. He was a clerk at the office. The £1.09 was given out at the time, and he was a clerk there, and this man got the loan of his coat, and one of the fellows that was in the ambush, and I suppose he took off the coat and threw it in the field after him, and the officer came up in the field, and when the fellows retreated, he picked his coat and he searched it and got this letter addressed to Tom Kinnall. Three of the soldiers sent the wife up the Pound Road, and she had this child in her arms, and they kept her covered with the rifles above at Stack's Gate on the Pound Road, and they took the husband down, they dragged him down as far as where the cross is now, and they shot him there, and he was dying at the time, in a dying condition. And one of the officers said, "Take him up now," he says, "the house was in flames at the time. Take him up now, drag him up and throw him into the flames," he says. One of the soldiers, it was said, refused to carry him. He'd been a Catholic. He said, "No, sir," he says, "until the man is dead. And when he's dead," he says, "I'll comply with your order." So with that, he said, "I'll court-martial you," he says, "for this, for not obeying my order." So at any rate, the other three and the officer dragged him up, and the heat was so bad that the officer caught him in his arms, and he only went halfway and flung him in through the doorway into the flames, and the house was burning mad. And the following morning I was coming over milking the cow, and I saw the smoke coming from the windows, no roof. The house was roofless. And there was two lads there, and they were digging him out, taking him out, and he was underneath the mortar and the slates and timber. I suppose a couple of feet down. The whole thing collapsed in on top of him, and there was nothing in the mortar remains, only bones. Not a, all the flesh was burned away. But a strange thing about the whole affair, he was saying the rosary that night before the officer called, and he was kneeling down saying the rosary before he got to bed. And sometime then afterwards the officer called, and when they had the house burned the following morning, there was the statue of Our Lady was still there intact, no burning, no smoke, only there was a kind of a slight burn up along at the back of the statue, which was never touched. So it just proved to you, I suppose, the power of God. There was a fellow named Wheatley, an Armstrong, and Haynes. He was a driver. And, he was like a thing that had come from the grave. He was all bones. You would hardly see any flesh in him. And he had two eyes, like burnt holes in a blanket. God, he was an awful looking rich. And there was a fella here named Socks. And if you said, he'd pull up the trousers, and he had a pair of women's socks up to his backside. And he'd drill three holes in your hat. He had a terrible shot. And Socks, he was calling him. So this old lady, he was a funny kind of a bloke. You wouldn't normally make him. But this old lady was standing in the door. And we said, "How are you getting on, Mr. Stockings?" Is she? Socks, they called him. Well, he said, "Do you know what it is?" He said, "I blow your cluck off." He said, "If you say another word to me, you bloody imbecile, what the hell do you think who I am?" So he went across the road, and there was this draper. He had a big shop there. His son was running now. And he had a dead sitting him. And he was walk up and put his backside against the Protestant gate. "I hope this isn't a Roman Catholic church or a synagogue," he says. And he looked around and he stuck his backside up against the gate. He had a revolver in the holster and it loaded, of course. And he had a dead sitting, this fellow. "I'll send a quick and sure messenger after you, my lad," he said. "He didn't clear the bloody shop. He said, I want all the good yet in the bloody road. Take it all out," and he said, "I'll blow your bloody cluck if you don't be ready and quick." So with that, "Listen, my friend, I'll complain you." And he had a big belly in him, and it was like the hulk of the Queen Mary, the bottom of the boat, that the gun boat. "Put on the tallest hat in your ship," he says, "in your bloody skull, and I have a good, I'll make a target of you. I want to test my shooting," he says. So he had to stand up on the counter, the man, and he put on the tallest hat that was on, it was like a creamery tank, it was so high, it was tipping the ceiling. So he pulled the gun, and he put seven holes through the hat. But that morning, it was an awful scene. There was smoke coming from houses that were burning, and it was coming out of windows and doors, and the town was in terrible state. And I'll never forget it. I was going over milking the cow, and it was a sad sight. Every you'd only go about 100 yards and you'd see a house smouldering away after the fire.
There is a postscript to all this. In December 1921, the Anglo-Irish Treaty was concluded in London, signed between members of the British government and representatives of the Provisional Republican Government in Dublin. Among the terms were the withdrawal of British military forces from 26 counties of Ireland. The incorrigible Paddy O'Dwyer, still a schoolboy in February 1922, was among those who watched the departure of the local garrison in Ennistymon. It was not without incident.
The Christian Brothers said, "I let you home earlier than usual to see the Thames going away." So he let us out, and there was about 200 or 300 people standing opposite the barrack. And I was sitting on the sill of the window, and there was a man, a young fella, he went to school with me, Danny Fitzpatrick. He was sitting, he was standing a few yards away, and I was sitting in the sill of the window, and there was another chap that I went to school with, Francis Brennan, and he was standing by the side of me, and this man, a tall tan, came out a man named Swain. And I was sitting in the sill of the window, and there was a big crowd in front of me. And he shouted, "Get away, you bloody Irish. Get away," he says. So when the crowd then wouldn't move, when he saw that they weren't going to go, he pulled out the revolver and he fired 3 shots into the crowd. And I saw one woman fall, drop in front of me. Well, out a bit from me, a few yards. And 5 minutes after, the bomb came across the road. And I was sitting in the sill of the window. And the bomb was behind, it rolled in behind me, and it was almost at my heels. And I felt like my clothes on fire from the effects of it. And I put on my hand like this to see what was wrong. And when I looked back, like behind me, the next thing, there was a blast, and a flash of light came out of it. And I was put up in the air, slashed against the ground, unconscious, and the crowd were running in all directions, of course. The panic started in, and they were running here and there. So Dr. Garrahy, at the time, was called, and he came, and a man named Mick O'Loughlin, he is dead now, and he carried me up to Rowan's furniture store at the time, and there was up to about 27 or 28 knocked out. We were all left inside in the furniture store, and we were laid out on the floor, and all my clothes were taken off. And before that, I could feel the blood run down my sleeves and trousers. And it was kind of lukewarm, and I knew there was something wrong. And but after that, then, they brought me up to the garage, or to the furniture store, and they cut all my clothes off and stripped me there, bandaged me up. Mrs. Rowan went up and she took the sheets of the bed and made bandages out of them, and we dressed us below in the furniture store. So Dr. Keane was in London at the time. He was a surgeon in Innstymon Hospital. And he was away, and they rang him and they called him, told him what happened, and he came that night, late that night, and he performed the operations the following day. So I was beyond for a long, long time in the hospital, in the old workhouse at the time. I got 23 or 24 wounds in the body, and there's 2 of my toes yet, and you can drive a pin through them, and I have no feeling. They're numb. And the shrapnel is in my body yet. There was 7 or 8 of my teeth knocked out of my head, and the gum torn back to my ear. And the shrapnel is in my body yet. It was never taken out. Of course, surgery hadn't come to that. It hadn't come up to the station where it is now. But if that happened today, of course, the shrapnel would be removed. But I still have it in my body.
Innstymon today is a pretty market town, tucked back from the coast road to Lahinch and Lisdoonvarna. Many of those whose homes were burned in September 1922 received compensation for the destruction. Some houses were rebuilt, others improved. Its shopfronts have the mark of antiquity and are much admired.
Show you Innstymon. We're walking down Parliament Street now. We have some lovely old shop fronts as well, and on the left here we have the old courthouse. And
do you know what that was used for, Pat?
Well, it was the courthouse, but right now, Jackie, it's used by the county council for dustbins and general dumping purposes. This is Parliament Street. And on the left-hand side here, we have a lovely old shop front here, Heinz's. It's an old pub. And last year, the man here was thinking of taking down his shop front to change it for a modern one. and he's changed his mind, and as you can see, he's made a beautiful job of it now, refurbishing it and painting it, and lots of tourists stop here to take photographs of it, and we're very pleased now that he has retained the old shop front.
In the 50s and 60s, it went slowly downhill, and people didn't have the money to modernise the shop fronts and put up the tile monstrosities that were put up in other towns in Ireland. And because of that, I think, it escaped the plastic and the neon that other towns have got. So now that it's got money in the 80s, I think people are much more aware of shop fronts and they stop and think before they modernise their buildings.
In fact, so many have gone in the last 18 months that we were getting very concerned last year. But I think with our festival here last year, it helped people to become aware of what they had. And some of them have changed their minds against aluminium and plastic, and they're holding on to the old wooden frame.
If it had all been modernised, the tourists wouldn't come here anyway, would they? Because it would be something not worth seeing.
Yes.
It would have lost its the feeling that it has.
But we're trying to keep in touch with people too, because, you know, they feel it is progress to have aluminium or plastic, that it will bring more custom. But I think slowly they begin to realise that it doesn't follow that people will come just because it's like an American town. Or
it's interesting, and it's getting a name for its shop fronts. The Germans and the French and the Americans flock here every year to photograph the fronts.
This is Mal's health food shop now. It used to be owned by Hogan's, which was an old Ennis Diamond family. It was a hardware store, and they were also agents for the Cunard line. It is now a health food and thriving vegetable and fruit shop. He has retained his old shop front, and it's a wonderful shop.
It is. Look at the lovely arches on the windows and the beautiful columns. This was a very interesting feature of Ennis Diamond, the Grecian columns that are part of the old turn-of-the-century shop fronts. I think, Pat, they're a very interesting feature.
Oh, they are. They really are.
Well, I came over almost exactly 12 years ago from living in London with a group of people, amongst whom there was a music group, two of us were leather workers, three were fine artists, and between us we aimed in a year or 18 months to do various projects. Well, there was a music group, also two of us were doing leather work. Now that was the thing that survived, to the extent that there's a shop still over there. Three of the people went back after varying times. Two of those that went back make concertinas. The other one's a fine artist. And the three of us that stayed here, one is now doing silkscreen print Celtic shirts, and the other one's running a health food shop. So three of us are still in the area, and still we feel it's our home. I think I can speak for all three of us. Living here has given me an insight into British history that I didn't really know about before.
In proud and loving memory of volunteer Thomas Kinnoll, who was shot and burned by British forces during the sack of Ennis Diamond on the night of the 22nd of September 1920, may he rest in peace, erected by Joseph Kinnoll.
Well, this is Burke's pub in Church Street, and it's a perfect example of 1920 architecture, the first floor bay window, and it hasn't changed at all since the 1920s. It has been bought recently, and we hope the new owner will retain its perfect shop front in keeping with the other shop fronts of the town. This was a popular public house with a piano and sing songs, and it was rebuilt in the 1930s with compensation money from the English government.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.